This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Monday, with the newly elected Morrison government now securing a majority, we go to Queensland, which delivered the biggest upset on Saturday night. Voters turning away from Labor in droves.
Not only were they uneasy, they were angry and disappointed and disgusted. They're devastated at the thought that Labor doesn't want to talk to them anymore, doesn't want to hear from them, doesn't represent them anymore.
And Labor isn't the only group asking what went wrong. It's also a time of reckoning for opinion pollsters. But first, Scott Morrison now has the numbers to form a majority government. The Prime Minister, who claimed what he called a miracle win on Saturday night, has secured one of the biggest election upsets in decades and now has enormous power to forge policy within the coalition. The Labor Party, on the other hand, is in shock and is seeking a new leader. Political reporter Alexandra Beach begins our coverage.
As the dust settles, Scott Morrison's win is looking more and more convincing. The triumphant Prime Minister appeared on Sydney radio station 2GB this morning.
Today, as we start out again, the government in our third term, I think they just want to see us get back to work. They don't want to see politics in their face or anything like that. They've had their say, they've made their decision, now they expect us to get on with it and so they can get on with their lives.
Just over three quarters of the votes have been counted and five seats are still in doubt. But the ABC's chief election analyst, Anthony Green, predicts the coalition will win at least 77 seats.
So sometime today, Bass will tick over and is looking much more likely to be a Liberal gain. That will be the 76th seat, delivering the government majority. And at this stage in Chisholm, they're line ball in Chisholm, but the votes that come on past trends would favour the Liberal Party, so Chisholm would be the 77th seat.
The Prime Minister, now a Liberal Party hero, is turning his attention to picking his frontbench team. Several ministers quit politics just before the election, and the Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham, says Scott Morrison can now reshape the ministry to suit himself.
There's always an element of generational change at every election and also when some of the significant leaders or figures of the past move on. And I'm sure that we will be able to take a strong and united government forward.
The government's then hoping to bring the parliament back by the end of June, and the first item on its agenda is likely to be passing its promised tax cuts. A trickier issue will be climate and environment policy. In Queensland, where Labor suffered a wipeout, Resources Minister Matt Canavan is calling for work to begin on the Adani coal mine.
I just think it's a great win for workers in this nation. Workers have stood up here in Queensland and had their voices heard.
But others argue that with such a tight result in the polls, the government should try to reach out to those voters who didn't back the Morrison government. Here's Simon Birmingham again.
We need to make sure that those Australians who doubt our commitment in relation to meeting climate change targets are convinced that they do see that we meet and exceed in this term of parliament the 2020 commitments that were made, and they have confidence in us to act there regardless of some of the doubts they may have had in the past.
At this point, Scott Morrison is holding his line.
What I took to the election is what I'm going to do.
But while the coalition has a few tricky issues to work through, Labor is dealing with an identity crisis. Frontbencher Anthony Albanese and Deputy Leader Tanya Plibersek are both running for the party leadership. The Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen could also be a contender, although some believe he's too tainted by the election failure. The Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon is warning that whoever gets the job needs to make some big changes.
Well, we certainly have to get back to the centre and we have to reconnect to our working class base, reconnect with those blue-collar workers, talk more about them and their cost of living pressures and less about some of those issues that are more aligned with the left side of the debate.
If no one suitable with a good connection to the regions steps forward, he'll put his own hand up.
Well, some might say I'm getting a bit old, but I won't rule myself out if I'm not convinced that people aren't prepared to make that commitment, then I'll have no choice but to fly the flag myself.
Formally choosing the next Labor leader could be a lengthy process.
Political reporter Alexandra Beach. Well, let's go now to Queensland, which was identified early in the election campaign as a battleground state, and on Saturday became the bloodiest of battlefields for the Labor Party. Labor had hoped to pick up seats across the state, but more than two-thirds of Queenslanders handed their votes to the coalition. Some of Queensland's Labor Party elders say the Adani issue was botched from the beginning. In Brisbane, Rachel Mealy reports.
Queensland!
Scott Morrison was quick to thank Queenslanders for the political gift he'd been handed. The Labor Party recorded a primary vote in Queensland of 27% and won just 5 seats outright. Now the Labor Party is left to figure out what went wrong. Rob Shorten was the Labor member for the state seat of Rockhampton and a minister in the Beattie and Bligh governments. He says the Labor Party faithful in his old seat felt they weren't listened to at the federal election.
Not only were they uneasy, they were angry and disappointed and disgusted. And they believe that Labor no longer wants to hear from them. They're devastated at the thought that Labor doesn't want to talk to them anymore, doesn't want to hear from them, doesn't represent them anymore, and even worse, desperately unhappy about not voting Labor, but a lot of them did, and for the first time in their lives.
Mr. Shorten stood at his local polling booth on Saturday handing out how-to-vote cards. He says the anti-Labor sentiment was strong.
I mean, I've lived here all my life, and the polling booth that I was on, there's been a Shorten on it since 1949. I've been on that polling booth for 50 years myself, and we got the worst result that we have ever had in the history of this seat. And I used to get 70% there. We got 29% there on Saturday, and these are people I went to school with who were telling me this, who were grudgingly taking a Labor Party how-to-vote card and did vote Labor, but should pass on a message to Palaszczuk or Trad or whatever about what we think about them.
Rob Shorten says there are major infrastructure projects underway across central Queensland, but the state Labor government isn't telling anyone about them. He says Labor has been tongue-tied on the issue of the Adani mine and on coal mining more generally.
You know, we just simply had a state government that wasn't getting its message through and wasn't articulating on the ground that it does care about the working people here, and a federal Labor that was equally torn over the issue of coal. I mean, we had a great policy on climate change. We said that we believed in reforestation. We said that we believed in renewables, and we wanted to get ahead of that market. But then we forgot to say to people that, by the way, we believe in coal because coal, every minute of every day, saves lives in hospitals. You know, from the scalpel used by the surgeon to the anaesthetist using whatever machines that they need to use fired by thermal coal. Nobody points that out, and that coal has got a future of another 50 or 60 years at the very least in state-owned coal-fired power stations here. And people see that, and they get disgusted by it.
Mr. Shorten says Labor has become too closely aligned with the Greens in the minds of voters in Queensland, and that didn't play well on Saturday. He says the LNP in Queensland made the Adani issue work for them. Matt Canavan, the National Party Senator for Queensland, came across as a voice for the region. Today, Matt Canavan was calling for the Adani project to get underway.
People of central Queensland have spoken, the people of Queensland have spoken. We're the locals here on the ground. I hope the rest of the nation does listen to us, and we just want the same kind of jobs and opportunity that the rest of the country just takes for granted.
Rob Shorten says he warned the federal Labor Party that the messages in central Queensland were wrong, but no one did anything about it.
It's been acknowledged, but nothing changed. No one turned their back on me, but just nothing changed, and something has to change.
That's Rob Shorten, a former state Labor minister, ending Rachel Mealy's report. This is The World Today, and if you miss a program or you've come in late, you can find all our stories on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to The World Today wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News, and you can contact me at Eleanor Hall 1. One of the key factors in Scott Morrison's victory was his campaign against Labor's franking credit policy. The Coalition branded Labor's proposal a retiree tax that would damage self-funded retirees. On the broader economy, the Fitch Ratings Agency has reaffirmed Australia's AAA credit rating, but it is warning the new government that it faces challenges. Here's the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Labor's franking credits policy infuriated investors, but especially self-funded retirees who'd used the legal mechanism to get tax refunds on dividends to bankroll their retirements. In the expectation of a Labor victory, fund manager Jeff Wilson had already booked tickets to Canberra to lobby independents, crossbenchers and minority parties like One Nation to have the so-called retirement tax killed in the Senate.
Totally unexpected, and I'm a little bit amazed.
But now, even with Labor's defeat, Jeff Wilson says Labor's franking credits bet was a massive underestimation that caused unnecessary anxiety for some retirees.
I don't think anyone understood the really sad human stories. You know, one of the emails I received over the weekend from one of our shareholders just thanking me, it was saying, pretty much for the last 18 months, he's been waking up at 3 or 4 in the morning worrying about how he's going to survive. And he said his first full night's sleep was on Saturday night. So to me, this is a phenomenal relief.
Do you believe Labor's policy on franking credits really was the tipping point in the election?
Labor totally underestimated the impact that their franking credit policy was going to have on all Australians, not only the retired Australians, but their children and their grandchildren. And we did a survey of our shareholders, and 47% said that their children or grandchildren would change their vote because of this franking policy. So it was the intergenerational impact.
With a victory under its belt and Prime Minister Scott Morrison declaring a miracle, will he need another one to deal with a slowing economy and global headwinds? Speaking from Hong Kong, Fitch Ratings Associate Director Jeremy Zook reaffirmed Australia's AAA credit rating and was cautiously confident that a forecast budget surplus for next year still looks on track.
The re-election of the coalition government, we really expect that to bring broad policy continuity. And certainly the coalition government has done a good job of putting Australia on a trajectory of reaching a fiscal surplus by next year.
Do you see any headwinds that might threaten that return to surplus in the next financial year?
Certainly headwinds are growing in Australia. You're dealing with some domestic headwinds. So the housing market is one area of concern that we're looking at. You're also looking at growing external headwinds. You're dealing with a slowing global environment, and added to that, you have U.S.-China trade tensions, which have really re-escalated in the past couple weeks and given Australia's trade ties to China.
And with that slowing economy in Australia, we have unemployment on the rise, wages growth is slow or there's no growth at all, and also Australia's Reserve Bank looks like cutting interest rates perhaps twice this year. That's a pretty big challenge for the new government.
Yes, it is. If the unemployment rate starts to tick up and revenue collection isn't quite as robust as it has been over the past couple of years, that could certainly pose some downside risk to achieving the budget surplus by next year and over the forecast horizon.
The Australian share market predictably bounced on the coalition victory and was more than 1% higher in late morning trade.
That's the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. So what do business leaders want to see from the newly elected Morrison government? The Committee for Economic Development of Australia, CEDA, has members from more than 780 businesses, community organisations and government departments. Its chief executive is Melinda Salento, a company director and economist who's served on several boards, including Woodside Petroleum, and was chief economist with the Business Council of Australia. When she joined me this morning, I began by asking her what the business leaders she represents are most keen to see from the new coalition government.
With any newly elected government, the real opportunity is to start a new and reinvigorated reform conversation. So that's the opportunity before us. I think the message I took from what the community was saying through this election is that they're very interested in jobs. You know, jobs matter and our economic future matters to them. And there are some really important issues that need to be addressed. But I think one of the things that has to be done is that we're always connecting all of those issues back to what our economic future is and how they impact on people's daily lives.
The Australian economy is less robust than it appeared at budget time, and there are concerns about the international economy. Does the Morrison government need to recalibrate on big budget-hitting promises like the tax cuts?
Look, I think there is now a sense that there's more uncertainty about the economic outlook both here and overseas. But in some ways, you could actually look at the increased uncertainty and think, some income tax cuts might be exactly what the economy needs. You know, I think the most important thing is that we focus on making sure the economy remains strong. Some issues, you know, really came out of this election that I think the community and business are looking for some certainty around how we're going to respond to things like climate and our energy future, and that there are really important conversations that will need to be had.
What do business leaders want to see on climate change and energy policy from the newly returned Morrison government?
Look, I think the message from business has been really clear on climate and energy, which is that we need certainty around that so that businesses that are making long-term decisions can do so with an eye to what the policy settings are going to be. So the government is committed to 2 degrees, and it's important now, I think, to focus on how we can achieve that outcome in the best way possible for Australia.
The Reserve Bank's Deputy Governor Guy Debelle warned this month that climate change is a systemic risk for our economy. To what extent are business leaders already taking that into account, regardless of the government's actions?
Well, I think actually what you've seen is a lot of businesses already responding to this, and certainly businesses that are talking to investors and shareholders are having to answer questions about how they're responding both to potential policy outcomes and uncertainties, but also the impacts of climate on their business directly. So I don't think business is slow in thinking about these issues, but certainly the message would be that greater policy clarity is what they need. The ongoing question is to make sure that we will be reaching the commitments that we've made, that we're doing this in a way where resources are allocated as efficiently as possible. You know, we're a resource and energy-rich country, including renewable energy, and I think what business wants to know and what the community wants to know is how we can turn that into a source of future prosperity and what the policy settings are that are going to deliver that.
One of the opportunities was mentioned by one of the most senior politicians in Scott Morrison's team, Arthur Sinodinos. He says that handled well, Australia has the capacity to be the Saudi Arabia of alternative energy. Do you agree that Australia has that sort of capacity, that sort of leadership potential?
Well, we've definitely got the capacity. I mean, we've got tremendous resources. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of focus on our resources in oil and gas and coal and the like. But we've got tremendous opportunity, I think, in renewable energy. And we're already starting to see conversations around the role of renewables and hydrogen. And these are things that we really need to look to as a source of opportunity for us in a global marketplace and as a global contribution to reducing emissions.
So how important is pressure from the business community on the government in getting solid and certain policies on climate and energy policy? Do business leaders really need to step into the political arena more?
Look, I think you've already seen a bit of that in the past year or so with key business leaders coming out and speaking about the benefits of putting a price on carbon, for instance. To be honest, the message I've taken from the election is that there are great opportunities for Australia ahead. There are challenges as well, but one of the things that we really need to do is actually work on building stronger consensus around the areas that we agree. And I think that's the message on this, that there is a consensus now around the need to be tackling these issues of climate and energy. We now need to look at how we can work together to achieve that. So, you know, I think it's business voices, of course, it's community voices as well, so that they understand the implications for them, and that on the basis of good evidence, in fact, we move forward with the best answers for Australia.
Even that phrase that you used, though, putting a price on carbon, was once political poison.
Look, I think it was. And I guess we just need to get to a space, I think, where we're having those conversations, we're having them based on fact and what we think is the best answer for Australia.
And do you have confidence, and indeed is there confidence among business leaders, that Scott Morrison and the Coalition can now deliver what is needed, especially now that Tony Abbott is no longer in the team?
Oh, I think the best thing now is that we've got an opportunity with the election out of the way, quite frankly, to have reinvigorated reform conversations. And if we've got a majority government, I think that would give people confidence that we can make some clear progress and that business and the community are going to be very invested in seeing that happen.
Melinda Cilento, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Melinda Cilento is the Chief Executive of CEDA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. We're returning now to the seat count for the Morrison government. A short time ago, the former independent member for the New South Wales seat of Wentworth, Karen Phelps, did concede defeat to Liberal Dave Sharma. Dr. Phelps thanked her supporters and urged Prime Minister Scott Morrison to focus on a key issue highlighted in her campaign for re-election.
I would like the Morrison government to act with urgency to address the many environmental challenges facing our country, particularly the need for definitive policies to guide the transition to a clean energy future. That is so important. Our children are speaking out now about their future, about what they need for their children and their grandchildren, because this is a multi-generational challenge. And unless we take action now, we will miss the action that we need to take to ensure a clean energy future, to ensure an energy where climate change is limited.
That's Karen Phelps, the independent who won the seat of Wentworth last year. It was when it was vacated by former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. She's just conceded defeat to Liberal Dave Sharma. Well, the Labor Party wasn't the only shock loser on Saturday. Opinion pollsters were also stunningly out of step with the results. But one data analyst did predict the coalition victory, and he also correctly called the upset win for Donald Trump. So what is he doing differently? Connie Aegis reports.
All the major pollsters put Labor in the winner's circle ahead of the federal election. No one ever claimed it's an exact science, but how did they get this wrong? Martin O'Shaughnessy is a partner at Omnipoll and was the CEO of the market research and data analytics company NewsPoll for 10 years.
Those polls, many of them, weren't using full probability sampling, where everybody in the population had a chance of being surveyed. Previously, we had the White Pages phone book with everybody's address and everybody's phone number. As people's use of the mobile phone has gone up and the landline has gone down, there's no White Pages published for people's mobiles, and so it's much harder now. Today, you will find that that person might be called by a robot. You might find that that person is accessed by an access panel where they've already volunteered to do surveys. Now, these work reasonably well, but the problem is they're not fully representative.
And he says the problem could have wider ramifications.
It can be fixed. That database, the IPND, exists. It's owned by the government, and industry has been negotiating with them for a number of years to make it available, because the quality of polling is suffering and the cost of polling is going up. Now, polling is just the tiny tip of the iceberg. Maybe 1% of all of the market research done is polling, and you know, maybe a third of it is actually planning services for government. So government has a stake in fixing this problem too.
Martin O'Shaughnessy says research was conducted following the failure of pollsters to predict the outcome of the US presidential election in 2016.
Our professional body, APOR in the States, actually did a big study on which polls got it right and which polls got it wrong. And what they found was that the very good quality polls, where they had a human calling somebody on a telephone, were mostly right. But they were in the minority. About 80% of the polls at a state level were done using robo, cheap panels, other forms of contact that didn't include everybody. And their errors were in the 5 to 10% range. The only methods that deliver really good results are methods that use the telephone and call people all over rather than just in small groups.
But some think there is another way. Professor Bella Stantic is the director of Griffith University's Big Data and Smart Analytics Lab. He analysed social media posts to accurately predict Scott Morrison would win the election.
They predicted other elections, including US election, federal election, Queensland election, Brexit and so on. So it's basically I analyse huge amount of public social media data, collect them specifically for particular keywords relevant to the election, and then analyze using the algorithms that I and my big data lab developed. And using this algorithm, identify the target, calculate the sentiment. After that, it's a pure data mining method, clustering with the location, parties, preferences, and everything. And when everything adds up, it came with the numbers which clearly indicate to me that a part of Victoria and South Australia, that Labor Party don't have numbers to take over the government.
He says there are a number of reasons why his method is more accurate than traditional polling methods.
First of all, maybe they're reducing the sample size. I had about 2 million tweets in the last few days before the elections with from about 500,000 unique users. And their sample size is, I think, in range of 1,000. Another more important reason could be because people don't have a landline. And the third reason is because people are more honest by telling their friends or indirectly telling the information which my algorithm are extracting.
Professor Stantic says polling companies may need to start using non-traditional methods to expand their sample size for more accurate results.
Indeed. Connie Agius reporting. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.